The court will proceed to the third case of the day, the United States versus Johnson. Ms. Paris Asaka.
If it pleases the court, my name is Kelly Paris Asaka, and I represent the appellant, Henry Johnson. Beforehand, I've requested that I receive 2 minutes for rebuttal in this case.
That when the white light goes on, you'll have 2 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor. We request this court reverse the judgment of the trial court for the reasons set forth in our brief. Today, I will address one point in support of our position. I will rely on my brief for the other arguments. We believe that the judgment should be reversed because the trial court improperly admitted 404B evidence of prior drug sales and gang affiliation, which denied the defendant a fair trial. The defendant was severely prejudiced by the government's excessive use of 404B evidence. The defendant vigorously objected to the admission of the 404B evidence in pretrial motions and during the trial. The trial court admitted the 404B evidence the government wanted introduced at trial on the basis that it was being admitted for the limited purpose of showing that, one, the relationship between the witness and the defendant, two, the nature of their relationship, and three, to show intent of the defendant. Now, the government's first witness was Nolan Nelson. Mr. Nelson testified for over 3 days about prior drug and gang activity he and the defendant engaged in from 1993 to 1998, but prior to the year of 2000, where the period of time started in the indictment. Also, this testimony, at least 90% of Mr. Nelson's testimony involved uncharged conduct. In determining whether such evidence should have been admitted under Rule 404B, the court uses the following four-part test. The court considers, one, if the evidence is directed toward establishing a matter and issue other than the defendant's propensity to commit the crime charge, two, that the evidence shows that the other act is similar enough and close enough in time to be relevant to the matter and issue, and three, that the evidence is sufficient to support a jury finding that the defendant committed a similar act, and four, that the evidence has probative value that's not substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. Now, the government argues in its brief that Nelson's testimony was properly admitted to show relationship, nature of relationship, and the defendant's intent. And because in conspiracy cases, evidence of prior bad acts is probative as of a material issue other than the character when those acts show formation of the conspiracy or the prior relationship between the conspirators. However, over 90% of Nelson's testimony focused on a time period from 1993 to 1998. Count 5 of the indictment, the criminal conspiracy, started in 2000 and continued until late February of 2002. So the government didn't need this evidence to prove the formation of the conspiracy in this case. Furthermore, Nelson's testimony concerning drug and gang activities from 93 to 98 may have shown some relationship between Nelson and the defendant or the nature of their interaction. But admitting such evidence, some of which fell at least 7 years outside the time period stated in the indictment, was highly prejudicial to the defendant since such evidence is not close enough in time to be relevant to the matter at issue. In addition, even if such evidence may show relationship, nature of the relationship, or the intent, the government did not need to use Nelson's testimony concerning uncharged conduct from 93 to 98 for this stated purpose. The relationship, the nature of the relationship, the intent of the defendant, this could have been established using, should not have been established by using such highly prejudicial evidence. The government should have been required to establish that these stated purposes using evidence that would not have been so clearly prejudiced the jury against the defendant.
I want to take you somewhere else for just an instant. What did Mr. Johnson raise any issues below related to the sentencing disparity for crack versus powder cocaine?
Yes, he did. I believe he raised it in his motion. It was raised during sentencing.
Yeah. Now, his entire criminal history consists of driving on a suspended license twice?
Yes.
And from that, he goes on to a life sentence, correct?
Correct.
And that, of course, was the result of the drug quantity.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. In addition, even if such evidence may show relationship, nature of relationship and intent, the government did not need to use Nelson's testimony concerning uncharged conduct from 93 to 98 for this stated purpose. The government should have been required to establish these stated purposes using evidence that would not have been so clearly prejudiced the jury against the defendant. In U.S. v. Simpson, this court held that evidence is unfairly prejudicial if it will cause the jury to decide the case on improper grounds. Here, the jury was invited to conclude that defendant's prior drug and gang activity proved his guilt for the crimes charged in the indictment. Furthermore, the fact that Nelson was the government's first witness and for 3 days the only evidence the jury heard was concerning uncharged conduct that was at least 7 years old is further evidence that the government's true intention for introducing such evidence was to show the defendant's propensity to commit the crimes charged. Finally, although the court issued a limiting instruction to the jury concerning the 404B evidence, said limiting instruction was inadequate. After hearing 3 days of testimony concerning these uncharged conducts, there's no limiting instruction that the court could have given that would offset the prejudicial effect of the 404B evidence. Other co-defendants such as Craig Abbey, Thomas Robertson, Anthony Buckner, they also testified concerning uncharged drug activity prior to 2000, and their testimony was admitted for the same purposes as Nelson. And this testimony was also prejudicial to the defendant and should not have been admitted. However, Nelson's testimony was much more prejudicial and denied defendant a fair trial due to the government's placement of Nelson's testimony and the fact that most of his testimony involved uncharged conduct. Furthermore, the jury's exposure to such highly prejudicial testimony so early in the case clearly shaded the jury's view of the defendant and made it easy for the jury to believe that the defendant committed the crimes charged in the indictment. It's not hard to see that after the jury heard Nelson's testimony, that the jury believed the testimony of any witness after that point involving drug activity, alleged drug activity of the defendant, would not be adequately scrutinized or the testimony would the jury would not adequately judge the credibility of each witness. In conclusion, the testimony of Nelson and other witnesses concerning the uncharged drug activity was improperly admitted under 404B, and in particular, Nelson's testimony should not have been admitted because such evidence did not satisfy prong 1, 2, or 4 of the four-part test for admission of such evidence, and that one, the evidence was obviously admitted or offered to show propensity for the defendant's propensity to do the crimes charged in the indictment. Two, the relevancy of such evidence since some of this evidence was at least 7 years old. And four, that the probative value of this evidence was greatly outweighed by its prejudicial effect. Thank you.
Mr. Hartzler?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Joe Hartzler on behalf of the United States. I'll be here with you for the next four cases, and I will dispense with introducing myself again, if that's permissible.
It certainly is.
I'd like to begin by addressing Judge Roper's question. I reviewed the sentencing transcript yesterday. I did not see any indication that there was a Kimbrough-type objection, so I think that issue is forfeited by this defendant.
In other words, you think that it wouldn't affect the sentencing here at all?
Well, I won't be surprised that we after March 3rd or on March 3rd receive a motion as a result of the change in the guidelines, if that's what you're asking. But in terms of Kimbrough, bear in mind this is a case that involves not only crack, but a substantial amount of cocaine and a substantial amount of marijuana. And I also believe that with the combination of those three drugs, his guideline, his offense level was off the charts. So yeah, I guess my answer I didn't mean to be indirect. The answer, I believe, is yes. It was not an issue in the district court. I understand that this court may be struggling with the whole post-Kimbrough consequence of these cases, but I'm thinking that if you give individual attention to each case, this may be one in which any kind of remand might not be necessary. But again, there's a little bit of a safety valve in that the guidelines have changed, and we're likely to see a motion that will send it back to, not send this back to the district court, but it will come back into the district court for a review of whether or not the judge would reduce the sentence as a result of the guideline change. I hope that answers your question, Judge Rovner.
Thank you, Mr. Hartford. You know, the district court allowed in evidence of drug sales dated back 7 years before the charged conduct.
That's right.
And I understand, you know, that this was useful to show the relationships of the co-conspirators. But the second justification, that this death demonstrated his intent to sell, just seemed, forgive me, but a bit suspect. The quantities alone would have shown intent to sell, and that reasoning would swallow up the rule excluding this kind of evidence whenever someone is on trial for a second drug sale offense. I mean, do you see where I'm going? Or?
Well, I think so, but I thought that the evidence in this case was introduced primarily because it was a conspiracy case and to establish the relationship between these various co-conspirators. I believe that's the precedent in this court, which we cite in our brief at page 51 to 52, and I don't need to take your time to recite all of that, but I believe that gave the grounds and justification for introducing this. And obviously, each of the co-conspirators that worked for Mr. Johnson had some substantial history with him. I guess the most substantial was Mr. Nelson that's been referred to here this morning. And he's the one that had the, I believe, 7-year history of on and off drug dealing. I also think that the relationship in this particular case was important to establish because otherwise it would have seemed incredibly odd for these people just to have begun their testimony in the year 2000 at the beginning of the alleged conspiracy. So that background information became highly relevant. Also, Your Honor, I hope you appreciate that the background evidence was, while of course prejudicial as any of this evidence is, on balance, it was not nearly as highly prejudicial as, let's say, Mr. Kevin Turner's testimony. He's the Chicago cocaine dealer that was the dealer. So a great deal of this background information paled in comparison to that testimony, as well as paling in comparison to the testimony during the 2 years of this ongoing continuing criminal enterprise in Quincy. You saw in the transcript testimony of some of the co-conspirators, for example, about the rules that Mr. Johnson established for how they would deal the drugs, the two different procedures that he adopted. And that was all, those were procedures that they followed during the years of the charged conspiracy, 2000 to 2002. So I'm sort of trying to grant your point, but point out that a lot of this background information was used exclusively for that purpose. It was not abused or misused in opening statement or closing argument. It did appropriately establish a background that these co-conspirators had with Mr. Johnson. And then, once we got into the evidence of the conspiracy from 2000 to 2002, there was really overwhelming evidence.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. If you have no further questions, I'll rely on my brief for the other issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
I don't need any
Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court.